This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We demand climate justice!
We demand climate justice!
We demand
climate justice!
We demand.
Coming up on Radio EcoShock, hot from Copenhagen, American energy and the destruction of Africa. Two continents adrift in hard choices. We know climate change is upon us. It's just a matter of how fast and how bad, as the struggle stretches from Washington to Denmark to Kenya, where the president's family live among the growing millions of climate refugees.
People, that's a large number of detentions. We're hearing that many of them have been detained as a preemptive measure without actually committing any offence. Is that the case?
That's correct, and I can help you. It's more than 700, nearby 900 people.
And we need real reductions of 45% or more below 1990 levels. And, you know, that is to avoid absolute climate chaos. I mean, the climate scientists have their hair on fire about this stuff. I mean, we're already seeing massive impacts. 300,000 people per year already die because of global warming. We're destroying entire ecosystems.
A global warming, an average global warming of 2 degrees, would mean that, in fact, temperatures in Africa would rise by 3.5 degrees. This, in effect, would make large parts of Africa uninhabitable.
Which is the equivalent to the death or the suicide for the African continent. So just after this, it was really an emotional moment. The ambassador Lumumba, which is a very respected person, even cried when telling about this.
But first, civilization as we've known it is coming to an end, brought down by a rapidly changing climate, a cancerous economic system, and the ongoing mass destruction of the non-human world. That's a quote and a starting point for our next guest, Paul Kingsnorth, a founder of the Dark Mountain Project. Paul is a well-educated and well-published environmentalist in England. He's been arrested at a protest, helped edit the Ecologist magazine and Greenpeace publications. He appears regularly in British newspapers, radio, and television. Paul, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's start with current events. Was there ever any real hope that climate change was going to be stopped by our current political leaders in Copenhagen?
I don't think so, no, not at all. And I think that the kind of the conclusion was pretty foregone from the beginning. I think that one of the ways that we, well, I think that the ways we look at climate change actually are probably the wrong ways. We look at climate change as a problem that we can solve within a certain amount of time if we can just get the technology right and if we can get the political will and if we can build a big mass movement of people. And I don't think that's really what it is. I think climate change is almost an existential problem for us. It's a predicament we have to live with rather than a problem we have to solve. And I think the root of that is the fact that climate change, you know, we treat climate change almost as if it's something external. It's a sort of problem that we've created that we can solve with human genius. But I don't think it is. I think climate change is our society. Climate change is who we are. Climate change is our computers. It's our televisions. It's our flights. And we're all complicit in it, those of us living in the rich world. And the system that the political leaders who gathered in Copenhagen have to promote, because it's what their voters want them to promote and it's what global corporations and the global economy want them to promote, is the system that creates climate change. So it's almost impossible to believe, I think, that they can turn around and suddenly click a switch and turn it off again. And I think that we're having real trouble understanding that. I think that applies to environmentalists as well as to the public as a whole. I think we still see climate change as kind of a challenge that we can tackle with the sort of old-fashioned methods of protest and marching and letter writing and campaigning. And I don't think it's responding to that at all.
One thing brought home to me by the alleged leak of the Danish text is that we in the West are committed to the expediency of atmospheric imperialism, if you want to call it that. We'll keep polluting even if we lose whole countries or continents in the less developed world. Am I being pessimistic or is that realistic?
Well, this is one of the things that the Dark Mountain Project was set up to try and distinguish between pessimism and realism. I think that the whole of the kind of environmental movement in which I've been involved for a long time is built on this kind of edifice of hope. And, you know, hope can be a very good thing, but if it's false hope, it's a very dangerous thing. And we've almost come to believe that anything's possible if we just hope for it enough. And I think we need to take a cold and a hard and a realistic look at the way the world is and the way that human society is and the way that human society is rubbing up against the ecological reality. And that's one way. It's all very well, you know, taking to the streets to kind of urge our leaders to act at Copenhagen, but our leaders are running this enormous machine, and this machine is about cannibalizing resources from the rest of the world. It's about keeping the consumer economy going. You can't just turn that around however much mass public action you have. And the problem is with climate change is that actually you're never going to get millions of people on the streets to campaign against climate change, because they'll be campaigning against their own way of life. They'll be campaigning against their own comfort, in the West at least. And so we're all complicit in that system. The voters are complicit, the corporations are complicit, the politicians are complicit, and we might want to stop climate change, but actually I don't think that we can, at least within the timescale that's apparently available to us. And I think we need to be honest about that, because only when we're honest about that can we start to think about what we do next.
Well, that's a good point, really. And the Copenhagen talks have been a focus for so many environmental groups, and now that circus is over and the media will move on to something else, they've covered it, they'll say. So there's bound to be a letdown in the movement. What happens to environmentalism now?
Well, I think that if you look at the history of environmentalism, you can trace various different phases. Perhaps you can trace a phase of conservation environmentalism and a phase of romantic environmentalism and perhaps a phase of radical environmentalism. And I think we need now to move into the next phase. And I think what we need to accept is that we have hit and exceeded a lot of ecological limits. And when I say we, I mean human civilization. I think we have this idea that when we fight to stop climate change, or when we talk about sustainability, that we're fighting to save the planet or even to save the human species. And actually, I don't think we're fighting to save either of those things. I think the planet will be fine. It's gone through much worse than this. I think that the human species will survive. What we're actually looking at the end of is the civilization that we've grown up with. Now, that doesn't mean it's the end of everything. It doesn't mean it's an apocalypse. But it does mean that we've created this enormous edifice, this huge industrial civilization, which is cannibalized nature. It's changing the atmosphere, it's emptying the oceans, it's destroying the forests, it's exhausting the soil. We've got 10 billion human beings coming along who are all going to want to live Western standards of life, and it's not possible for that to happen. And that's going to be a hit that we're all going to have to take. We're going to have a real contraction in the way that we live materially, particularly or especially those of us in the West. And the question really is, are we going to do that voluntarily, or are we going to have it forced upon us? And I think, unfortunately, that the answer is probably that we're going to have it forced upon us, because I don't think that we're capable of making the changes that we need to make.
Yes, here in North America, Dr. Bill Reese has talked about a smart decline, but it hasn't caught on. And I noticed that your co-partner in crime there, Dugald Hine, has been working with collapsonomics. It kind of reminds me of the fall of the Soviet-style communism. It didn't go from violent revolution, but nobody believed in it anymore. Is that where we're at now, with the big dream of consumerism and greed is good heading off the horizon?
Well, I think that where we're at now is a kind of very, very slow, painful awareness that we are constrained by limits. And I think that's something that environmentalists have to understand, but more so, I think society as a whole has to understand. We've kind of been a very pioneering species, humans, and certainly for the last couple of hundred years, where we've been fueled by fossil energy, we've basically been able to do anything. I mean, we've gone to the moon, we've gone to the stars, we've conquered every continent on Earth, we've built amazing machines, And we've all grown up with this idea that we're going to keep doing that. We're going to keep progressing. We can break every boundary. We can do anything we want. And the fact is that we can't, and neither can any other species. And we're pushing the boundaries of what we can live within. And we have to start adjusting to the idea that there are limits and we have to live within them. And I think that's a real painful kind of psychological change that we have to go through as a species, and particularly in Western culture, which is very much built on that kind of imperial expansion model. And the technological expansion model, it's kind of deep within our DNA, and we really don't like the idea that we just can't keep plowing onwards. And I think this is where the kind of climate denial movement comes in, and it's also where some strands of environmentalism come in that believe that technology will solve everything if we can just get the alternative fuel cells right and all the rest of it. There's still this kind of almost magical thinking that we'll somehow be able to transcend limits. But I don't think we will, and I think that's what we really need to try and get a grip on, and it's hard to believe in, but it's true.
Well, let's talk for the economy for a minute. You know, in the United States, Obama's chief economic advisor, Lawrence Summers, just told the press the recession is over, jobs are coming back in the spring. What is your impression of our economic situation in the developed countries?
I think, firstly, it's very telling that Barack Obama got Lawrence Summers to be to be in his cabinet at all. I mean, he's a very notorious kind of ex-world banker and kind of neoliberal hawk. So it shows you what kind of direction the economy is going in. But I think that what's happening in the West is that the same thing has happened here in Britain as well, is that we have borrowed vast, vast amounts of money that we can't afford in order to prop up an economy which is failing. But we haven't made the changes that are needed in order to make that economy sustainable. So I think we've probably created a sort of false dawn for a while. Things have calmed down a bit. Things are certainly not as bad as they were 6 months ago. But the idea that we've created any kind of sustainable plateau, it's been very interesting to listen to the political and the media debate, and maybe it's been the same there as it has been here. But as soon as the crash happened, all of the thinking was about how we could get back to how it was before. And we had to prop up the economy, we had to inject money, we had to pay off the banks, we had to buy up the banks, we had to do anything to get the economy back on track. And of course, getting it back on track means getting it back on the track of unsustainable growth, which is what got us to this problem in the first place. And it's socially unsustainable, but it's also ecologically unsustainable. We're trying to run a growth economy on a finite planet, and that's the root cause of all of our environmental problems. And that was another issue with Copenhagen and all of these global summits, is that all of the leaders there talking about contracting our greenhouse gas emissions are the same leaders who then go to another summit and talk about expanding the economy. And it's the ever-growing economy that makes these demands upon the planet. It's not just climate change, it's all of the other ecological pressures too. And, you know, we've got an economy which is, I think, growing like a cancer cell, and we don't know how to realign it. And until we've worked out how to realign it again, all of this other stuff is window dressing, really, because that's the root cause of the problem.
Right, it's like cigarettes. We're hooked on growth, but it's killing us. It sounds, though, are you suggesting that collapse might be the best thing for the planet as a whole at this point?
It's a very hard question, isn't it? I mean, I don't think it would. It's a very good question. It depends what you mean by the planet. There's a very strong argument that plenty of deep ecologists make, particularly in North America, that the best thing that could happen for the global ecosystem would be the collapse of the human economy. And there's certainly plenty of evidence to support that. If you look at the biggest contraction of fossil fuel emissions, for example, the only time where any serious reduction in fossil fuel emissions has happened over the last 20 or 30 years, it was the collapse of the Eastern Bloc and the Soviet Union. And the economy collapsed, and it immediately did a lot less damage to the natural world. But I don't think that kind of praying for collapse in any way is a long-term solution. It's also potentially very inhumane. It would be very, very difficult for people to cope with. And there's no guarantee it would lead to any better treatment of the global environment. But my kind of conclusion after sort of 15 years of environmentalism really is that collapse is pretty unavoidable. I think it's probably already started. Certainly climate change has started. I don't see any prospect whatsoever of keeping below 2 degrees of climate change. We don't know what the feedbacks will do. We've got a completely unsustainable economy that's just roaring out of control, bringing goodness knows how many millions of new people into it every year. Whether collapse is good for us or not, I think that it's probably inevitable. And so we ought to try and think about how, if possible, we're going to deal with that kind of reality, I think.
Well, in a way, you touched on it, perhaps some of the solutions in your book, Real England. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with one of Britain's provocative public voices, Paul Kingsnorth. And in Real England, you describe the last truly British experiences as global business chains and mass marketing wipe out the last of the people's culture. And it's a little late for a book like that here. I'm surrounded by malls, and they all look the same. And we buy the package, and the brand name is really all there is. The box is generally kind of empty. Is there a movement in Europe to find more meaningful lives, shall we say?
I think there is. And actually, it's probably stronger in some other parts of Europe than it is in Britain. I think Britain is probably, unfortunately, a bit more far advanced down the sort of North American mall road than some other countries, but we've still got a fair bit of it going on here. There's a lot of interest in slow food. There are a lot of interest in farmers' markets. There's a lot of campaigns against McDonald's and all that kind of thing. But I think more broadly, amongst quite a lot of sections of the population, there's a kind of awareness of the importance of local economies and the importance of the local cultures that are attached to them. And the importance of resilience, because I think if there's one thing that we ought to be doing, whether or not we're facing a collapse, which I think we are, but even if we weren't, if there's one thing that we ought to be doing, it's looking to local resilience, community resilience, the resilience of people in places, the resilience of local economies and local economic networks, because the thing about the global economy is that it's intensely fragile. I mean, a superstore in Britain, for example, will hold about 24 hours worth of food because they run these just-in-time delivery systems and they're very efficient on a, if you've got a supply chain that constantly works, but if the supply chain breaks for any reason, you've got food shortages within a day. And this is not, it's actually not a resilient system at all, and it's not a very efficient one. If you've suddenly got a problem with, say, your fuel supplies or your food supplies. So what we ought to be doing is building resilience, and that means cultural resilience at a local level and economic resilience too. And I think that's something that really can be focused on without having to wait for our leaders to go to Copenhagen or wherever and come up with a document. That's something that for most of our history, for 99.5% of human history, we've always had workable, resilient local communities. And what sort of global consumer capitalism, if you like, has done, particularly in the West, is it's destroyed those and it's replaced them with shopping. And it seems very pleasing to people on the surface, but as soon as the system starts to fall apart, it doesn't work anymore. And if you've undermined all of that resilience by doing that, then you're in trouble. So that's certainly one thing that, as you say, we could be really focusing on right now.
I'd like to get back to the Dark Mountain Project. Listeners can Google that or just go to dark-mountain.net. It's a flashpoint for those who see our present society as in difficulty, shall we say. Now, you're not suggesting that we should go back to the good old days of medieval living with 6 billion people on the planet. So you've touched on one of the solutions there, resilient cities and or societies, and we have covered that here on Radio EcoShock. Do you have some other ideas of things we should be looking at?
Well, one of the things we're doing with the Dark Mountain Project, it's a cultural project. One of the things we're trying to do is almost sidestep this whole discussion about problems and solutions, because much of the environment movement is focused on this. And it treats the kind of the state of society as a kind of pathology which we need to have a medical cure for, and we need to find the cure, whether it be a technology or a particular system. And that's, you know, a lot of that's very valid. It's not the wrong thing to be doing, but what we're trying to do with the Dark Mountain Project is look from a cultural angle almost. We're trying to form a cultural movement, and what we're trying to do is examine the stories that we've built our society on, because I think that every society that's ever existed, including ours, has foundation myths, and it has stories that it believes about itself, and they are stories that inform the direction that it goes in. We've just been talking about economic growth, for example, and one of the big foundation stories of our sort of post-enlightenment industrial society is the idea of progress, the idea that every generation is better than the one before, the idea that technology always improves, that the human condition always improves, that life is very linear. You start off at the bottom and you end up at the top. And that's a very, very specific Western kind of ideal of society. And it informs a lot of our ideas. Another of the myths of our society, I think, is the idea of human centrality, the idea that we're separate from nature. This comes from Christianity, and it's bolstered by current philosophy, and it's bolstered by sort of scientific rationalism, the idea that we're this incredible species which is entirely different from anything else, and we can pretty much do what we want because we have the ability to do it. And all of these kind of myths, these stories that we tell ourselves about who we are, they inform the kind of society that we build and the way that we look at the future. And we're trying to question those, and we're trying to come up with new ideas. We're trying to rewrite the stories and look at them in a different way. So we wondered what would happen if you tried to bring together a movement of writers and poets and musicians and artists and thinkers and just anyone who's interested, I mean, you know, as well as artisans and people with practical skills, and start to try and rework some of the stories and question some of the narratives, because I think that's, you know, while it's not a practical movement, it's not a practical move in the kind of everyday sense, it's, I think, something quite seriously important that we're failing to do. It's almost the root cause of the problem that we've created for ourselves, and I think it needs to be examined again.
And these may be stories of uncivilization?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're calling it uncivilization. It's, and we see that as a as a process, not a place, not a goal. When we talk about uncivilization, we're not talking about a kind of primitivist manifesto. We're talking about a process of unweaving the myths of civilization. We have this wonderful belief in the indestructibility of our civilization, which is something, incidentally, that I think all civilizations have probably had, and all civilizations have collapsed, and there's no reason ours would be any different to that. So we're talking about uncivilizing ourselves in the sense of cutting ourselves off from those myths, standing back, looking at them, asking ourselves why we believe the things that have got us to this point, and what we ought to be believing instead, what's trying to distinguish between our self-image, if you like, as a species and as a culture, and the reality. It's almost like stepping back from your ego as an individual and trying to understand how other people see you rather than the way you see yourself. And that's the kind of thing that we're trying to do. And we're trying to sort of spread these tentacles out into society as a whole and see if they catch on.
We haven't talked much about the majority of the people on this planet, the billions who are not worried about what kind of mobile phone to buy next. From Asia through Africa to South America, the prospects for a just world seem dimmer than ever to me. Would you agree with that?
I think it kind of depends, actually. I think it kind of depends what you mean by a just world. I think that, again, there's a narrative which is that we're the developed world, we're the rich guys and we're the lucky guys, and the poor people out there need to have what we've got. Now, that's obviously true to some degree. I mean, it's clearly true that we have excellent things like, you know, healthcare and transport systems and things to which other people would like access and have a right to have access. But there's also a sense that I think that we have, as I say, we've cannibalized our own culture, we've cannibalized our own economies, and we've created something here in the West which is very fragile, which in other parts of the world, which in some ways are poorer, isn't the case. And if you look at something like climate change, for example, you hear a lot that it will be the poor countries that suffer most from climate change. And again, in some cases, that's obviously true. If you live in Bangladesh, you're going to be in trouble. And there's a lot of action needs to be done to help out vulnerable communities. But there's also a sense that if you live in a country which still has a functioning village economy, for example, if you live in a country which in which the landscape requires you to have skills and to have community and to have, you know, and you've got extended families around you and you've got a sustainable and resilient local economy, then in some ways you might be better off if the global economy collapses than you would be if you were living in a city in the West. So that's one way of looking at it. I think another way of looking at it is that there are, in my first book, the one I wrote before Real England, that was a book called One No Many Yeses, and that was a global journey through the what I called the global resistance movement, the kind of anti-capitalist movement. And I spent a lot of time in poor countries, in poorer communities, and I saw then, and it's still the case now, that there really are enormous movements out there in South America and in Africa and in Asia and in Indonesia and all over the place, and they link up in some cases with similar kinds of movements in the Western world. There are enormous movements of people who are rejecting the system, and they're not, you know, what we might call sort of outsiders or hippies or anything. In the West, they're peasants, they're ordinary people, they're farmers, they're tribes people, there are millions of them altogether, and they are working on precisely this kind of alternative, sustainable, resilient community system. And I think in some cases, people in the poor world have a much, much clearer view of the injustices and the weaknesses of the global economy than we do here, because they're less reliant on it and they can see, they're at the sharp end, they can see the damage. So in one sense, there's not going to be a smooth path to the kind of global justice that we might once have thought there was. But I think in another sense, there's going to be a lot of anger. That was one thing you saw at Copenhagen, actually, even from the governments of these poorer countries, a lot of anger from the poor world and the less developed world about just constantly being screwed by the rich again. And I don't think that people will put up with it for much longer. So in one sense, I think you're probably going to see a lot more resistance and organization from people in outside the West.
Well, you've raised some really good points, but you talk about anger, and I worry about as people lose their jobs, as people have to lose perhaps their homes and their cars, the kind of anger that's going to come up in the West. Are we risking a new kind of fascism here at home as living standards decline?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, that's a big concern for me as well. And I think I mean, it varies from country to country, but I certainly have the impression in Britain that that democracy is really in a very messy state. It's sclerotic. People just do not trust politicians. They don't trust the system. They don't vote. We recently elected a couple of fascist members of the European Parliament, unfortunately, just in the election we had last year. That's more common in Europe than it is now. You know, it's not to suggest we're going to see a rerun of the 1930s, but I think that there's going to be a real appetite, actually, for anti-politics movements and for, yes, maybe people from the far right with easy answers. And there is a lot of anger out there. I mean, you certainly see it in the US, and you see it increasingly in Europe as well. There's a lot of people who don't want to accept this, don't want to accept the way the world is changing, don't want to accept the fact that things will be straightened and the society will be contracting, and they'll want people to blame. So it's a real worry. I don't really know. I don't really know what to do about it, actually, other than to kind of watch it. But I think that democracy is in a real mess, actually, or what we've come to call democracy is in a real mess, because it's been bought up by the economy. I think it's a wholly owned subsidiary of a global market, and people don't trust it anymore.
Yeah, just so obvious with what happened to the Obama dream, too.
Well, exactly. I like Barack Obama. I think he's probably a good guy, and I think he's a well-intentioned guy. And I think he probably meant the things he said, but he can't do them.
Yeah.
And maybe he only realized that when he got into office. He can't do them. He's not really running the country. And that's true everywhere, I think.
Well, when we're looking at this 21st century predicament and we're trying to work our way through it, who are some of the thought leaders that we should be exploring?
Gosh, it's hard to say, really. Thought leaders. I mean, some of the people that interest me most are the deep ecological thinkers, whom there are quite a few in North America. I mean, people like Kirkpatrick Sale in the U.S., for example, or even Illich, who's now dead but was a very important thinker, Theodore Rotzak, some of the really important deep ecologists who are trying to forge a way between the human view of humanity and the human view of the world, because I think another thing that's going to be a real challenge for us is accepting our place within the natural world, which ought to be a fantastic thing for us to accept, because it sees us as kind of embedded in a web of life rather than kind of separate, isolated individuals. But I don't think it's going to appeal to many people. So I find some of the deep ecologists the most interesting people who are out there at the moment. And I think also just people who are talking about and thinking about at local level some of the ways to make things happen. From Subcomandante Marcos of the Zapatistas has always been a great inspiration of mine, because he's not only a poet and a good writer, but he's an activist. He's a man who is deeply embedded in his community, and he's tried to look at how you can make a rural community and a tribal community and a sort of peasant community work in a modern world, in a modern setting, and how you can have almost a strange combination of resistance and peace. And there are all sorts of interesting people like that out there from all sorts of communities in the global south, if you like, who are some of our most interesting people. I mean, I don't see anything personally coming from any mainstream political leaders of any interest at all. And I don't find very much coming from what you might call the traditional left either, that has anything really to offer that isn't very tired and dry. And I think the people who are looking at that grassroots level and that level of embedding us back into the world as a whole are the most interesting people for me.
And Paul Kingsnorth, what's next for you?
Well, what's next for me is at the moment I'm putting together the first issue of the Dark Mountain Journal. We're looking for submissions of writing and poetry and art and other things that fit in with our kind of uncivilized manifesto, which you can read on our website. We're holding the first Dark Mountain Festival in Wales next year, and we're going to see how the movement takes off. It's been really amazing and heartening to see how many people have been interested since we launched it in July, in quite a low-key way, and we've had people from all over the world, including Canada and North America and all over the world, actually, Indonesia, China. You'd be surprised how far people are coming from, expressing their interest in this and saying, we're so glad that you're saying this because it's what we've been feeling too, and we're quite excited about it. So I think that we might be touching on a nerve, and I think that we might be sort of burrowing into something that a lot of people are feeling, and we hope that we can push that forward and get these debates going and start to sort of move on to the next phase, because it certainly is needed.
Our guest has been Paul Kingsnorth. Read the Dark Mountain Manifesto at dark-mountain.net and find out more at paulkingsnorth.net. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Paul, we've just scratched the surface. I'm hoping you'll come back again, perhaps, in the spring.
I would love to, yes. Thanks very much for having me.
Stick around. We're off to Copenhagen with voices you've never heard from the mainstream media. What Obama can do, no matter what watered-down roadblocks Congress puts in the way, and why the fragile culture of Africa will boil away with just 2 degrees of global temperature rise. Guess what? People there are not willing to die for our energy economy. From out of the darkness, it's Radio EcoShock. There is no single story coming out of Copenhagen, the climate talks in December 2009. There are hundreds. Today we'll cover the struggle of just two continents, North America, the great wealthy polluter, and Africa, the poorest victim of global climate change. We'll do it as only radio can. On a shoestring, a band of radio activists found the voices we never hear in mainstream media. They broadcast it daily to London, to Resonance FM, and to the States through Democracy Now! You'll hear Amy Goodman, Phil England, and Frederica Whitehead, plus audio from 350.org. More importantly, you'll get firsthand the voices of the dispossessed, the representatives of Africa. In spite of my years of studying climate change, my many interviews with top climate scientists, I never understood until now the real impact of climate disruption on Africa, where hundreds of millions depend upon simple rain-fed agriculture, the rains are not coming, or flood out everything when they do. Wealth measured in cattle is now mile upon mile of skulls strewn across the widest part of the continent. Lake Chad, Africa's largest lake, has almost disappeared, drying out into a few marshes. It's hard to imagine. Even farming-rich South Africa is drying out, with worse to come in the next decades. We all need to wake up and listen to the distress calls from Africa. Meanwhile, the oil empire of America is trying to decide what to do. We'll begin there with a quick news bite from Amy Goodman, an interview with Cassie Siegel on the legal moves, and then Naomi Klein on Obama's damage.
On Monday, the Environmental Protection Agency said six gases, including carbon dioxide and methane, endanger the environment and public health. The move would allow the EPA to take action against greenhouse gases without needing congressional approval. EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson made the announcement Monday at a news conference in Washington.
Does America have to gut the Clean Air Act to make new climate legislation? Here is Phil England of Climate Radio with Cassie Siegel.
Welcome to Copenhagen Daily, reporting from the Bella Center in Copenhagen, on what is undoubtedly the most important meeting in human history. Thanks for bearing with us while we find our feet. Copenhagen Daily is a networked experiment amongst a number of people both here in Copenhagen and in London.
So I'm here with Cassie Siegel from the Center for Biological Diversity in the US.
Co-author of a new report, Yes He Can.
The report, it's called Yes He Can, President Obama's Power to Make an International Climate Commitment Without Waiting for Congress.
Okay. First, I thought we'd look at what Obama is currently said he would bring to Copenhagen, just to put everything in context for people and how that matches up and whether it's good enough. But what has he currently said he would do?
What the president has proposed is for the U.S. To put a politically binding deal on the table to cut emissions about 17% below 2005 levels by 2020. That translates into only about 3% below 1990 levels. And this proposal is completely inadequate because it's completely out of line with what the science says we need to do. The science says we need to get carbon dioxide back to below 350 parts per million. That means reductions of 45% or more from the U.S. and other industrialized countries.
And that's without using offsets as well?
Well, that's without using offsets because offsets generally don't get you real reductions. And we need real reductions of 45% or more below 1990 levels. And, you know, that is to avoid absolute climate chaos. I mean, the climate scientists have their hair on fire about this stuff. I mean, we're already seeing massive impacts. 300,000 people per year already die because of global warming. We're destroying entire ecosystems. Polar bears, a species that I work on, they're drowning, starving, and even resorting to cannibalism just from the rapid climate change we're already seeing. We're approaching or have already passed tipping points. And the 3% below 1990 levels that's on the table will lead to catastrophe. It's not something we can go forward with.
So is Obama coming forward with the 3% because that is what the House of Representatives have currently passed? And if so, I understand that actually that form of legislation, if that were to go right through Congress, you had a graph the other night that showed a Breakthrough Institute analysis that with offsets, actually there might be an increase in carbon emissions under that kind of cap and trade style legislation. So what's going on?
Well, that's right. The president's proposal mirrors the reductions that are in the climate bill that passed the House of Representatives this summer. And while the bill says that it aims to reduce emissions 3% below 1990 levels by 2020, actual U.S. emissions could continue to go up all the way through 2026. The reason that is because the bill contains 2 billion tons of offsets. And to give you a sense of scale, the total emissions of the U.S. economy is about 7 billion tons per year. So with 2 billion tons of offsets in the bill, you could have actual emissions continue to go up all the way through 2026. So polluters would continue to pollute. They would just theoretically be paying someone somewhere else to say that they're sequestering carbon or reducing carbon or what have you. But if you have actual emissions go up through 2026, we're talking about climate catastrophe. We can't allow that to happen.
Now, there's been a new development, I understand, this week with Lisa Jackson, head of the Environmental Protection Agency, making an announcement about an intention to go ahead and use existing authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate things like coal-fired power plants. Is that in order to back up this 3% pledge, or is there something else going on?
Well, it's actually separate, and that's one of the things we address in our report. It's often stated that the president can't commit to a deal here until Congress acts, or that we can't start reducing our emissions in the U.S. and commit to numeric targets until we get a new climate bill. That's actually not true, because we already have a law called the Clean Air Act. It is one of the world's most successful environmental laws, and it already provides a comprehensive system for the reduction of greenhouse pollution. The Bush administration refused to implement the Clean Air Act for greenhouse gases. The Supreme Court said that was illegal. And now the Obama administration is going forward with pollution reductions under the Clean Air Act as a result of that Supreme Court decision. And so it is really a fallacy to say that the president's hands are tied because Congress hasn't acted. The president can commit to science-based, deep and rapid emissions reductions here in Copenhagen, and he can achieve them through the Clean Air Act. He just needs to fully implement the law. What most people don't know, though, is that the climate bills under consideration in Congress would actually gut the Clean Air Act, and they would prevent the EPA from using this existing law, which is much stronger than the new climate bill, from actually solving the problem.
Now, some people have been saying that the Obama administration has been using the threat of EPA authority as a kind of bargaining chip in order to get a kind of cap and trade bill through. So it's like saying to industry, if you don't accept this actually industry-friendly legislation, then we'll kind of clobber you with some proper regulation. But does the Lisa Jackson announcement mean that it's no longer a bargaining chip, but they're actually going to go ahead and use it regardless?
Well, we certainly hope so, and we and others have been working on this intensely. Lisa Jackson said something really good the other day. She said this isn't an either-or situation, and that's what we've been saying all year. It is a ridiculous way to frame the issue, to say that you have to have climate legislation or the Clean Air Act. There's absolutely no reason for that. The Clean Air Act is the strongest tool, the best tool for reducing greenhouse pollution. It's also completely compatible with any other tool that Congress might want to put in place. So, for example, when Congress put in a cap-and-trade system for acid rain in 1990, they did that. They didn't take away any of the Clean Air Act's programs. They left that safety net in place for the acid rain pollutants, for sulfur dioxide and oxides of nitrogen. This notion that we're going to trade the Clean Air Act for a new cap-and-trade bill is an absolute travesty. We must not do that. We have to keep the safety net of the Clean Air Act, whatever else Congress chooses to do.
Okay. Realistically, what do you think Obama is going to do at the end of next week? I know you've been petitioning along with 350.org, the Obama administration, or perhaps the Environmental Protection Agency directly, in order to use their existing authority to do something which is consistent with the science. I don't know, are the wheels turning fast enough for that to happen, or is this meeting going to end in crisis that everyone expects?
Right, well, it's a long shot at this point for a good outcome here, a very, very long shot. You have to be an optimist to believe that the future is uncertain when you work in climate change, unfortunately. But one of the things we're trying to do with our report is we're trying to get the word out there that these assumptions that the president's hands are tied by Congress or that we can't act until we have a new climate bill are false. And when the administration says that 3% below 1990 is the best they can do because we don't have a climate bill, that's absolutely incorrect. The president has all the legal tools he needs to cut a deal here. When the administration has the political will to get something done, you do not hear them complaining about Congress blocking it. They get it done. And we want everybody to know that it is not a legal constraint on the president if he doesn't put a better deal here on the table. It is a political choice. And I'm not trying to downplay the difficulty of the political situation in the U.S. We have enormous challenges. We have misinformation and confusion about climate science rampant. We have endless debates. But the president ran on a promise of change and a promise to take action on climate change. And it will be an enormous act of moral and political courage to do so. But that's what the science demands, and that's what we're asking him to do. The science says we must. The law says we can. And we need everyone to ask, demand of President Obama that he say, yes, we will.
Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman with Naomi Klein.
Naomi Klein, let's go on from what Martin Kaur is saying. The issue of the Kyoto Protocol in the United States is always talking about it sunsets, it ends in 2012. Mm-hmm. But that's not true.
It's one of the great misconceptions, and I actually didn't fully understand it until Martin explained it to me, so he probably can explain it much better than I can, but there is no expiration date on the Kyoto Protocol. What it had was a first period of emissions cuts that ends in 2012, and the idea was that countries would come back together and increase their emission cuts and develop the agreement. But the idea that it just needs to be scrapped completely and replaced with a wholly new deal, and that in addition to this, there isn't time to come up with a whole new deal, which is the position of the U.S. negotiators here, is based on this faulty premise that the Kyoto Protocol expires. But I think, you know, the real issue here is what they want to replace the Kyoto Protocol with is much weaker than the Kyoto Protocol. They want to, the Kyoto Protocol comes up with a goal for all the countries that they have to reach in terms of emissions cuts, and it's legally binding. Here, what they want to replace it to is all countries go off, come up with their own goals, and then it's sort of mashed together into an agreement that really isn't a multilateral agreement, because the whole idea of multilateralism is that countries agree on the same set of rules, and they agree to a common monitoring mechanism. So the great irony of what's happening here in Copenhagen is that it takes place in this context of this huge global celebration of the U.S. re-embrace of multilateralism. In fact, Obama is getting the Nobel Prize specifically for this. In the citation for the Nobel Prize, they talk about the re-engagement with the climate talks, the embrace of multilateralism. He's getting the Nobel Prize for it. But what's actually happening here is that they're using the tools of multilateralism, the infrastructure of multilateralism, to destroy multilateralism, to kill multilateralism.
Incredibly, in oil-dependent Nigeria, there has been a major conference calling for a halt to further exploration. Leave it in the soil to develop a real economy and to save the climate of Africa. Here is Phil England of Climate Radio with Nimo Bassi, head of Friends of Earth, Nigeria.
And who is involved with this? I understand it's quite a high level. Is it the Environment Ministry? Pretty much the whole of Nigerian civil society?
Yes, we had, at the end of the day, the resolutions of the conference was endorsed by 117 organizations, and the conference was supported by the Federal Ministry of Environment and the UNDP, as well as Friends of the Earth, Netherlands, and Oxfam Novib. The outcomes are not driven by those who supported the conference, but the civil society groups who were there, 117, fully endorsed what we did and what the outcome was. And you see, by leaving you all in the soil, you are stopping the release of carbon as a source. It's a major move to help check global warming. And we're saying that not only could oil be left in the soil, we should also not look for any other form of dirty energy. Leave the coal in the hole. Don't look for the tar sand, because this brings even worse environmental consequences.
It seems to represent a gear change or a paradigm shift almost in civil society's view on this, because up until recently it was much more about limiting local pollution, oil spills, local environmental damage, maybe getting a bit more tax revenues for development in the Niger Delta, things like that. But this is now a different demand. It's about saying actually this stuff is probably not so good for us after all.
Yeah, what we're doing is a major political and environmental demand. We want to be a real shift in the political thinking, and we want the Nigerian economy to be re-engineered, kick back to start, come back alive. The economy has been dead. People are living outside the formal economy. People are just surviving on their own. So, and there's been a complete disconnect between public revenue and people's prosperity. And we're saying when you leave new oil in the soil and recover a lot of oil from oil theft, whatever shortfall, people would contribute by paying for barrels of oil when you leave in the soil. You know, people are poor, they cannot pay, but they would try. There are people indicating that if they have a responsible government and system that would manage the economy properly, they are ready to make sacrifices. People want to say, yes, this is our money in the national purse. It's our money that has been spent. Spend our money right. Be accountable, be transparent. But, you know, when people just stay back and then oil revenues flood the national coffers and you have huge budgets and then nothing impacts the people. Since oil economy is almost like fiction, I mean, it's like voodoo economics. People are so disconnected from the resources, and a lot of decision makers don't even see the pollution. So there's no concern. So we want to restore a connection between governance and those who are governed.
We demand climate justice.
We demand climate justice.
We demand climate justice.
We demand climate justice.
But African representatives at Copenhagen were aggrieved and angry to discover their Danish hosts colluded with the biggest countries to write a kind of polluters treaty behind their backs called the Danish Text. Here is a clip from the spontaneous protest that broke out in the main conference hall.
There should be nothing more than 1 degree, because 2 degrees spells suicide for Africa. We are suffering enough. Africa should not be divided again. People should not take advantage of our poverty that has been caused by exorbitant lifestyles here, and we are not recognizing it and dividing our people again.
Sure.
We will not die in silence. Africa has been silent for too long, and you must listen to us. We are not asking for any aid. We are not begging.
One Africa,
one degree,
one position,
one power.
One Africa,
one degree.
We do not want to die.
The recording you have just heard was provided by 350.org, who were present during the action. One of the key problems for Africa is the 2-degree global cap. A global warming, an average global warming of 2 degrees, would mean that, in fact, temperatures in Africa would rise by 3.5 degrees. This, in effect, would make large parts of Africa uninhabitable. The target of attempting to limit global temperatures to a 2-degree rise is now 13 years old. And scientists are now telling us that serious damage will happen well before a 2-degree rise in average temperatures. And many people are arguing for the upper threshold to be reduced to a 1.5 degree rise or even a 1 degree temperature rise. In the recording, you heard the impromptu demonstration led by Lumumba Diaping, one of the Sudanese negotiators here in Copenhagen. Diaping was reacting furiously at the news that broke of a leaked document now known as the Danish Accord. You heard him leading the chart, no political deal. Political deal, bad deal. Nothing more than 1 degree. 1 degree, one Africa, one position. He's reacting against a divide and rule strategy that was revealed by the leaking of the Danish Accord. This was leaked to The Guardian, and you can read the full text on the website. Basically, the Danish Accord was a pre-prepared document which completely goes against the spirit of negotiations. Something that was pre-prepared and given to weaker, smaller countries to sign with some financial incentives.
Which is the equivalent to the death or the suicide for the African continent. So just after this, it was really an emotional moment. The ambassador Lumumba, which is a very respected person, even cried when telling about this. Cried about to see how he's seeing the delegates from different countries consider this this target, this text which is being now pushed, something which can be as a compromise as a text, while we know that 2 degrees Celsius of increasing of temperature is a synonym of death for all Africa countries, which are the most affected countries by climate change. This is why after we organized protestation outside.
Phil England put the same question to Nimo Bassi, who is the chairman of Friends of the Earth International and the executive director of Friends of the Earth Nigeria.
And we are really, really disappointed that these governments could sit down behind the back of the rest of the international community to concoct some kind of political deals that are wishy-washy, that don't recognize the urgency of the climate challenge, that doesn't recognize that we are at the brink of a major, major crisis, more than what we've ever experienced, that governments could sit down and prepare that kind of document that doesn't, even before negotiations started, it's a big slap in the face of the world. And it makes nonsense of us coming here to talk under the United Nations process. This is a way of disuniting the nations, driving a wedge between nations, dividing to rule. It's colonial, it's unacceptable, and it's actually very embarrassing.
Frederica Whitehead reporting for Resonance FM, London. And it all links back to the United States, historically the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. We'll wrap up with a passionate letter to Obama, written by the African delegates. Here is Phil England.
On the day that President Obama picked up his Nobel Peace Prize, which was awarded partly due to his re-engagement on climate change internationally, the massive civil society organization, the Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance, sent a letter to President Obama, pleading with him to fulfill the promise of his inauguration speech and to not betray his brothers and sisters in Africa. PACTA delegate Sylvia Wachara was kind enough to read it for us.
My name is Sylvia Wachara from the Pan-Africa Climate Justice Alliance. Dear Mr. President, we write to you with great pride and respect your leadership. You are known throughout our continent as the son of Africa. We are your brothers and sisters from Africa. We represent an alliance of civil society organizations in 43 countries across Africa that brings together a diverse group of people who share a common concern for our continent and the growing catastrophe of climate change. In your inaugural address to the presidency of the world's most powerful nation, you affirmed your commitment to help the world's poor by saying, I quote, "To the people of poor nations, we pledge to work alongside you to make your farms flourish and let clean waters flow, to nourish starved bodies and feed hungry minds. And to those nations like ours that enjoy relative plenty. We say we can no longer afford indifference to the suffering outside our borders, nor can we consume the world's resources without regard to effect. End of quote. We take these pledges seriously, and we intend to hold you to your word. Our rivers are drying, our crops are turning to dust, and unrelenting sun scorches our land, while others' areas are ravaged by storms and diseases. Scientists now say the world could warm by 6 degrees Celsius, and by more in Africa. This threatens nothing less than the collapse of our continent. Today, Africa grapples with a challenge that is not of our making. Impacts we had little role in causing. We find no alternative but to look to those nations that contribute most to causing climate change, and to call on them to lead by example. As the world's largest contributor to greenhouse gas concentrations, and as the world's wealthiest nation, the United States has a singular duty to ensure that Africa is kept safe from rising impacts of climate change. Yet, we find it failing in this duty, along with other leaders of developed nations you have proposed. 1. That global average temperatures be limited to below 2 degrees Celsius. Yet, this threatens catastrophic harm to Africa, which will likely warm by around 1.5 times this global average. The global emissions be limited to 50% of 1990 levels by 2050. Yet this risks a 50% chance of exceeding 2 degrees Celsius. And third, that Annex 1 countries cut their emissions by 80% by 2050, which would rob Africa of its fair share of atmospheric space and limit our prospects of development while we grapple with a more hostile climate. You are coming to Europe to receive a Nobel Prize in Oslo and to attend the UN Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen. You must live up to the dignity of the Nobel Prize when you come to Copenhagen. You must listen to the voice of other countries, including Africa. Our greatest single concern is that the United States seems to be seeking to continue domestic pollution well into the future by offsetting its emission in Africa, further transferring the burden of curbing climate change to those people who had little role in causing it. Furthermore, we are concerned that the United States, by insisting on remaining outside the Kyoto Protocol, has become a for other developed countries to seek to evade rather than implement their legal binding obligations under the Kyoto Protocol. This undermines the only international agreement that establishes binding international emissions targets for developed countries. These positions are unjust as they are unsustainable. We call on the United States and other developed countries to recognize their historic responsibilities for the causes and adverse consequences of climate change, and to repay their climate debts to Africa and other developing countries. Allowing temperatures to rise by up to 2 degrees globally, and thus to 3 degrees in Africa, is a death sentence to literally millions of Africans. We fear for our mothers and fathers, our sisters and brothers, your uncles and aunts and cousins. Your policy on climate change threatens not only our families, but also your own. We implore you not to crush the dreams of our fathers. Yours sincerely, your brother, your uncles, your aunties and cousins from Africa.
You have been listening to a quick digest of sounds from the Copenhagen Climate Talks, a dialogue between the United States and Africa. Find a rich mix of reports as free MP3 downloads at climateradio.org.
You'll find it isn't the result of the conference that counts, but the rich mix of voices and issues that converged on Copenhagen 1 December. Dig in deep. It's our common future at stake. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Broadcast on 20 stations in Canada and the United States. Going out over the world by satellite and cable, podcast and downloads, you've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Get tons of free MP3 downloads from our site at ecoshock.org. ECO, shock like an electric shock. It's radioactive.